Hello, and welcome to Heart, Soul, and Data, where we explore the human side of analytics to help amplify the impacts of those out to change the world. With me, Alexandra Mannerings. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am thrilled to be joined by Corey, who's going to talk to us on how we can do evaluation better in so many ways. So Corey, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you're joining the recording from, and how you came to the whole data and evaluation space.
Absolutely. And thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here as well. My name is Corey Newhouse. I'm the founder and principal of Public Profit. We work with mission-driven organizations to help them use data to make better decisions and ultimately to deepen and broaden the impact that they have in the community. I currently am in lovely Eugene, Oregon, in the northwest part of our country in the United States. Much of our team is based in the San Francisco Bay Area, just a little bit south of me.
I love it. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about when we come to evaluation, right? We don't always have the skills in-house to do it correctly. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how we can think of ways of building our capacity around doing evaluation, because oftentimes that's like the biggest place we have for doing evaluation better is even just building the ability to do evaluation or to do evaluation at the next level. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about some of the ways that we as smaller organizations can think about that capacity building.
Absolutely. And I think there's probably two or three different directions that I would encourage smaller organizations to take. One is to recognize that most organizations are already collecting a lot of great information, whether that is attendance records, case management notes, interviews, periodic reflections from the staff about what's working well. So many of our colleagues in nonprofits are such exceptional practitioners, so reflective, so thoughtful, and that they're generating data all the time. And sometimes what the difference is or what kind of that next step is just really getting in some good habits around collecting that information more regularly, writing it down, getting in the habit of doing some regular reflections. I think of that as getting around the cycle. Lots of organizations of all kinds collect a whole lot of information and really getting the hang of taking that pause to collect it, not just collect it, but to analyze it and to make meaning of it, I think is really helpful. I think the other thing too, another strand for smaller nonprofits to think about is how might they leverage the support of an evaluation consultant, someone like Public Profit, to really help them build up some infrastructure that then they can run on their own after that initial setup. As you alluded to, program evaluation can be really intense to set up. It has can have a fairly high startup cost in terms of time. And so just getting that jump start in terms of having someone externally kind of helping you refine the data collection tools that you have, and then setting something up that is more replicable over time. And then the last strand that I'll suggest, and this is something I think that a lot of small nonprofits do, is to partner with someone, a graduate student, a professor, someone who is doing evaluation or applied research as part of a course requirement or their studies to implement a specific project, which is usually free or very low cost for the nonprofit. And I think in some specific settings, that can be a really, really fantastic jumpstart for small nonprofits as well.
I really liked all three of those, and they're such great different areas that we can get involved in to advance this capacity. That reflect, pause and reflect habit of building that, I think is a really important one that we miss so quickly. I was just listening to an accountant actually talking about how to do small business taxes better. And she mentioned being good at doing your accounting isn't about being good at numbers. It's about being good at understanding what the numbers are telling you. And that just stuck with me because we are so used to saying like, oh, accounting's like a numbers thing. But really the numbers aren't that complicated and there's software that'll do it for you. Where the value comes is sitting down and looking at your balance sheet or looking at the money coming in, the money going out, and understanding what it's telling you and how that should impact the financial decisions that you make over the next month, over the next 6 months, et cetera. And I think to your point, that's where we can get stuck with data as nonprofits, whether we're looking at program data or donation data or whatever it might be, that it might be there, or we might spend a lot of time trying to figure out even how to collect it or, you know, what to do with it in our CRM, but we miss that point where we stop and say, what is this actually telling us?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that some of that has to do with the nonprofit starvation cycle, that so many organizations are just really underfunded, really, really undercapacitated. And I think also it has a lot to do with missteps that evaluation professionals like myself have made over the years, in which the program evaluation for way too many organizations is an extractive process that is meant to satisfy funders and nothing more. And what's more demotivating than that? Having to do paperwork, having to do bit or turns evaluation into paperwork that once a quarter we've got to run around with our hair on fire to fill out the report that nobody knew was coming or somebody forgot was coming. Of course, that's not interesting. Of course, that's not helpful. And similarly, I think evaluators too often have been really focused on sort of whether their own intellectual curiosity or meeting those funders' needs, rather than really thinking about how data can really inform and enhance practice and things that people who are doing work really care about. And some of that is a change in the type of data that's collected, but I think a lot of it is just really a change in mindset and sort of for whom are we collecting this information? Who is doing the learning from it? And certainly there are plenty of funders that have a long way to go when kind of appreciating that they should be second or third in line when it comes to data, you know, who's getting the data and why. But I do think that there's just, again, some really exciting opportunities with that mindset shift, both for nonprofit professionals and for evaluation consultants or professors or graduate students, the other folks that they're collaborating with.
And I think that there is, when you talk about moving beyond just like what we can do internally, then to that consultant space, right? You talked about that another way to expand your capacity is to bring in capacity that doesn't even exist within your organization. And I think that is a really important part for us to be aware of as nonprofits, that sometimes it doesn't even make sense for us to have that capacity in-house. And it can be more effective, more efficient to have it reside, you know, in a consultant, a third party that we can collaborate with. So can you talk a little bit more about how we can use evaluation consultants more effectively?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there are a couple different dimensions that come to mind. You know, one is as much as possible to have, if you do want to work with an evaluation consultant, to have them at least be around as early in the process as possible. And whether that is it's the start of a new school year and you have a school year program, or you're launching a new initiative, or whatever the start might be. And even if they're just around to kind of get that context, listen in, kind of understand the genesis of the thing that you're doing. And ideally to be able to help you set up some of those systems like attendance, like surveying, like case notes that are really preparing your organization for success in the future. So you're going to have that usable information and ways that you can work with it. Because on the flip side, when an evaluation consultant is brought in at the end, or sometimes months or even years after the thing is over, that just, in my opinion, that really just pushes us into compliance mode. That yes, there's always things to learn. Yes, there's always things to improve. But usually if something's over, it's over. And so we're missing out on that opportunity for that continuous learning, that continuous improvement, and that co-creation. And so I think that just as much as possible to have your evaluation consultant around at the beginning, whatever that is, helps a lot. And if you're on a limited budget, I totally understand, you can definitely talk with your consultant about ways to kind of ramp up their time. And so maybe they're more and more observer mode as things are starting up, offering some, you know, some specific advice on what your intake survey should look like or something like that, and then really dialing in later. But again, just so they can be there to understand the context is going to be real helpful. And then the second big thing, and this again gets back to some of the more extractive history of the evaluation profession, which many, many, many of us are working hard to shift, is to really understand the ways in which your evaluation consultant is going to help your organization build its capacity. And that can take a lot of different features or a lot of different shapes. At the very least, any data collection tool that they're developing, belongs to you as an organization. You should be able to keep it. Ideally, they're doing reports or other things in ways that are in software that your organization can use if you need to take it on. They're doing good documentation of the things that they're doing, so you can replicate it if you need to. And I think most importantly, that they're really working with you as an organization to co-create the evaluation questions, kind of what are those questions that we want to be able to ask and answer, as well as to really try to interpret the data collectively. And that doesn't have to be a huge lift. That doesn't have to be all of a sudden everyone on your team, you know, is doing what they're doing and being a professional evaluator. But it shouldn't be this thing that's just kind of happening off to the side, because that then again is just a huge missed opportunity for both for your organization to be benefiting from this collaboration, building your capacity, and equally important, for the findings of the evaluation to be useful for you. The easiest way to blow a whole bunch of money is to hire an evaluation consultant and not interact with them until the end of the project. Yeah, I guarantee it, their work is not going to help you to continue to improve, to demonstrate to your funders and community what you're doing. It does need to be a collaboration.
Sort of going back to what we started with, that like pause and reflect, that you want to make sure that you have a plan and an intention and then an execution of using the evaluation that your consultant, your partner is doing.
Yes, yes, yes. And and that's not to say that every recommendation that your evaluator makes is going to be like, oh my gosh, I never would have thought of that. Or, oh my gosh, we're going to do that tomorrow. But generally speaking, you're working with this group or this person to help yield new insights, help verify things that you have a good gut sense about, to open up new opportunities. And again, that can't happen if they're just kind of off on their own, doing their own thing.
It's come up several times already that one of the places that we're most likely to do evaluation wrong is to leave it siloed, or to leave it as sort of this external activity that isn't integrated into not only the activity of the program, but integrated into how we actually run our organization, like the operations of our nonprofit. So can you talk a little bit more beyond just capacity building, how we can make sure that we're incorporating the evaluation that we are doing more consistently and sustainably into our ongoing operation?
Yeah. And there's a couple different tensions to navigate in that. And it's not for no reason that it is unusual for organizations to be able to make lots of data-informed decisions and incorporate it into their daily lives. And so for any organization that is really struggling with that or sort of sees a better way of being, it's not because it's easy and somebody just hasn't told you how to do it yet. It's hard and it takes some commitment. That said, I think that there's, you know, a few things that I've seen with organizations we work with that really help them to really turn that corner. And one is what I think of as the equivalent of growth mindset, but for organizations. So Dr. Carol Dweck has this wide body of research around what's called a growth mindset or fixed mindset for individuals. And the very basic idea, if y'all don't know Dr. Dweck, go look her up. She's amazing. Is people with a growth mindset believe that the level of effort that they put into things is returned in terms of their success. And so they see their limitations as an opportunity to improve. They feel that if you put in more effort, you are going to get better at it. Of course, you know, it has limits. I'm 5'2". I can put a lot of effort into basketball and I'm not going to be in the NBA. But fundamentally, I believe if I put in the work to do something that's important to me, I'm going to get better. Fixed mindset, on the other hand, is what it sounds like, the idea that we have what we have, we are who we are, and additional work or effort does not really influence the things that we're able to do or our accomplishments. And I think that there's a parallel there in organization culture around, do we just do what we're doing, turn the wheel because that's what our plan is, or are we a learning organization? Are we learning people who want to keep getting better, want to keep getting those signals? Now, to do that, that requires a lot of psychological safety for the people who are in the organization, requires really good management so that the consequences of a mistake are not fatal professionally, but are seen as what they are, a mistake. That connects to perfectionism and white supremacy characteristics in organizations and many, many more podcasts worth of content there. But I think that it is possible. And I think that organizational growth mindset really then cues teams up for success to be using data on a more regular basis and to feel comfortable and excited about what are those signals that we're getting, what's the information coming back to us to help us keep getting better at what we're doing and keep refining. The timeliness is another big challenge for nonprofit organizations. It takes time to do observations. It takes time to do interviews. It takes time to do surveys. And that often, in our experience, what one of the challenges nonprofits face is by the time they get that information back, all the people who filled out that survey are out of the program, or there's a whole new staff, or there's been enough that has changed that it's nice to know, but isn't as actionable. And some of that is just cause, and until we build some time machines so we can sort of jump back and have the report before we do the thing are happening. But I do think that technology enables some really great opportunities for those kind of quicker bits of feedback, whether that's through polling. I think a lot of educational and youth development organizations have great ways of getting input from the community in quick ways, whether that's a feedback wall or a quick conversations in the hallway or other ways to get those signals. It may not be as heavy duty or comprehensive as a survey of everyone in the program, but can still get you some good signals. And then I think the third thing is another big challenge and tension that nonprofits face, I think, as a result of the first two, is that the data itself is incomplete and not very good. And it makes sense that if you are in your job, you are told to do X, Y, and Z thing, and you don't really know why, and you never get it back, and it doesn't help you do your job, why do it? I wouldn't do it. And so one of the big things that we really encourage nonprofits to do is to start using the data they have, even if it's out of date, even if it's a little weird, and get in that habit of looking at the data. And that as your team starts to build that tradition of looking at the information, the first time you're mostly going to talk about what's missing and why it's wrong. And oh my gosh, nice opportunity to say, how might we get fuller information? How might we get more up-to-date information? And really leaning into that deep passion and commitment that mission-driven professionals have for their work, have for their mission, and having the data be a complement to that rather than this evidence of that or this proof that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing.
One thing that I think surprises a lot of people when we have these conversations around how to use data better is how little of it is about technical intervention, right?
Yes.
We're not talking about using this statistical test or writing this Excel formula. Like everything you listed there has to do with how we as humans are interacting with the data. And there is a small piece, like you said, of making sure that the data are timely, which can involve some technology, making sure the data are more complete, which can have to do with some of the actual nitty gritty of data. But for the most part, this is about making sure that we're engaging in a way with our data that gets it to where we as humans need it, when we need it, in ways that we can engage with it and supports that we connect to it with the right mindset. You know, and that we mentioned that earlier. And so I loved so much of that because it is just, again, driving home that point that success with data beyond the actual technical part of collecting it and processing it is really about who we are as humans and what we bring to the table.
Yes. And I think that is 1,000%. I feel like evaluation is there's these ideas of adaptive issues and technical issues. And evaluation is 90% an adaptive issue and 10% technical. And again, I think that's where a good evaluation consultant can really be helpful because we have the technical knowledge, right? We've studied up on it. We know about the statistical tests. We know about the technology platforms, et cetera, et cetera. We're really blessed that in this day and time, it's pretty dang easy to generate data. That used to be part of the hard part. It is no longer. And so it is, yes, absolutely, there's technical aspects to it. And I think that sometimes people get scared or a little hung up on some of the technical elements, some of the elements connected to traditional ideas of rigor, because they took that one statistics class in high school or college, and they have these vague memories of like, oh my God, like it has to be this way, or like somebody's going to throw a hood over my head and drag me out of the room. Like, oh my gosh, like it has to be. And yes, absolutely, good evaluation, good data does have to meet some technical specifications so that we're drawing conclusions based on what is representative data? What is the, you know, kind of ideal, or as close as we can get to the ideal? And again, as you say, I think so much of it is about doing our best to get to that technical place and that place of methodological rigor. But far better to have a little bit of data that you're using that is really actionable, that you're using regularly, than to have tons and tons of data that you don't need at all or that you don't use at all.
I think another big part of this as well is that these human aspects, like you said, the adaptive aspects, need to be thought about at the beginning, not once you've done all of it. Because while they are human, the human parts are not necessarily an integrated part of the technical data collection, they may influence some of the choices that you make about the data to collect, or impact how you even approach the construction of an evaluation project. And so, you know, you mentioned very early on that one of the big mistakes people will make is not bringing in more advanced capacity or expanding that capacity early on. And they think we can just fix it at the end or make things work at the end. And it just struck me that, you know, for example, the timeliness, you may actually choose to collect different data because you realize that the original idea you had for the data is going to show up by the time it's not helpful. And so you may as well not even have it. So collect something else that's actually going to get the turnaround faster. Or that growth mindset, right? That you may not think that has anything to do with the data you collect, but in fact, you may want to be making sure you're getting data that will inform learning from mistakes or may inform improvement efforts and the measurement, that connection of the benefit from your effort. So that struck me as something interesting too.
And to build on that, I think kind of two things. One, a lot of our mission-driven clients are taking really explicit focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging in their organization. And there's actually a really fascinating connection between evaluation and DEIB in that often in conversations about what it is like to be a more inclusive, belonging-centered organization, we talk about enabling mistakes, letting go of the idea of perfection, widening our understanding of whose opinion should be centered when we're making decisions. That all interconnects with evaluation, or it can. And then the other thing I'll say, and I think this is, again, one of the longstanding issues in the evaluation field that is related to its extractive root, and I think related to the times in which data were harder to come by. A lot of times the evaluations skip right past the thing that the organization's actually doing. And so I'm a huge proponent, and this, as I was listening to you, it's what made me think of it. And if we're collecting information about the quality and the consistency of our services, that's far more useful to us. That's stuff that's more in our control than how a person, and that it is more directly connected to that final assessment or a person getting a job or whatever, you know, whatever your outcome is. And is, again, that more timely information. It's gonna you know, get back to you in times that you need. And I literally saw a few years ago a presentation of an evaluation design that had an arrow going around the program itself in terms of the data they were collecting. I will not name names, but I was godsmacked that there was all of this stuff about who the participants are and da 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 da, and all this information about their, you know, their grades and their test scores. And it literally had an arrow going around the thing itself. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, that is going to be so useless for the organization. That's not going to tell them a thing. And anything that comes out on the end, like, you're not going to be able to attribute that to people's participation in the thing because you don't know a darn thing about the thing itself. And again, I think there's lots of reasons why those habits are so ingrained in us. And I think that's to your point about kind of being involved a little bit more early, thinking about whose questions are getting asked and answered. And it's not that folks in mission-driven organizations don't care deeply about things like young people succeeding in school or people getting jobs or whatever, you know, whatever their outcome is, that they also need those good signals, that good information about how what they're doing is working or not, who's showing up, who's not, so they can be making those changes too.
A lot of what you just talked about gets back to looking at two versions of values that the organization has, right? The values in terms of what is it that they're investing in, what is it that is at the center of what they do and why they exist. And then the other half, or the other version of values, you know, goes back to your inclusiveness values and those sorts of conversations. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about that actual process of bringing values into the data collection process, into the evaluation definition process. Just how do we actually marry those and make sure that they stay together rather than, as you said, a more extractive data process that has nothing to do with the values of the organization?
So at the conceptual level, there is really astounding, just groundbreaking work happening both from a group called the Equitable Evaluation Initiative, EEI, as well as a broader area of practice called CREA, Culturally Responsive Evaluation and Assessment. And I want to talk about the principles from the Equitable Evaluation Initiative that, again, I think we're just do such an amazing job of reframing a lot of what evaluation is and is for. So principle one, and for those who can't see me, all of you, I'm reading off of their website, so don't get too impressed that I know these by heart. The principle one is that evaluation and evaluative work should be in service of equity. Two, evaluative work should be designed and implemented commensurate with the values underlying equity work, meaning that they're multiculturally valid and oriented toward participant ownership. And evaluative work can and should answer critical questions about the ways in which historical and structural decisions have contributed to the condition, the effect of the strategy on different populations or those underlying systemic drivers, and the ways in which the cultural context is tangled up in those structural conditions and the change initiative itself. That's heavy stuff, and really reorienting that is really different than did it work or not? Was the work plan implemented as such? And I think, again, this principle one about evaluation and evaluative work should be in service of equity is really powerful. And that I think that can really then kind of at that next level, if we accept some of these big principles, that then is going to change our thinking about whose perspective is centered in deciding what the evaluation questions are. I heard from a colleague recently at Grantmakers for Effective Organizations conference. She said, yeah, I've learned just to stop and look at my evaluation questions and think, who is going to use the answers to these questions? And it stopped me in my tracks. I was like, oh, dang, who will? And that even a really simple gut check like that, I think, can be so powerful. I think it also really affects how you think about what evidence is and how you collect data. And so, you know, what does it look like to get most proximate to the people or communities that are being affected by the thing? What does it look like to not collect everything in writing asynchronously? What does it look like to, you know, to embrace story and narrative and visuals and a much wider variety of information as evidence? And those are not easy things to do. And I think for most organizations, ours included, our clients included, we're making those incremental steps that it's not a, you know, all surveys are bad, all narrative is good kind of dichotomy. And I think it's really important for nonprofits and their collaborators to think about that and to be more, look for more opportunities to incorporate their values, their organizational values, into the ways that they're even designing evaluations or setting up evaluations and then the ways that they're conducting them.
I agree. That is some pretty heavy stuff.
Right? It is.
Very, very intense. And I'm curious, you mentioned a couple of good places where we can start to make that translation from a big, heavy idea to actually how you do that. Because as I listened to that, my first reaction was, how on earth would that even, how do you even make that into a reality? How do you translate this idea into actual actions that you're taking that would result in living those principles? And you mentioned considering more closely like what the actual evaluation questions are. And I think that's a really good practical place to start, is explicitly identifying the questions you're asking in your evaluation. Because sometimes we take those for granted and we didn't actually stop and think about, are those the questions we want? Why did we pick those? Who picked those? Mm-hmm. Who defined mm-hmm. them? And are they the ones we want? And I liked that addition of the then who's using the answers, because that's a separate question from what the questions are. Like yeah. Who will actually use the answers? Who will get the answers, right? Who gets to have access to those? I was wondering if you had a few other areas or a few other suggestions of actual sort of practical applications of that lived values and evaluation.
Yeah. And there's, I think, a really wide variety of different tactics and strategies that can be used. And some, I think, are really straightforward. Things like language access. are, if you're doing surveys, almost everybody does, are they in the languages that your community speaks? Again, I won't name names, but I'm shocked at the number of times that organizations that, and it's a resource question, I 1000% understand that, and is it in the languages and the reading levels that make sense to people? For communities that have more oral cultures, are you making these kinds of input opportunities accessible that way? Those, I think, are kind of some table stakes, if you will, kind of things that organizations can flow in. I think that there's also the question of, and this, again, I think is related to some of these equitable evaluation principles, where does the accountability lie? Who is being evaluated? We are very habituated to evaluating the nonprofit, and we're very habituated to evaluating the individual, usually the client, even if it is implicit there. What would it look like to evaluate the funder? What would it look like to evaluate the adults providing the service? Where are we locating that responsibility implicitly or explicitly? And again, I think it's just the waters we're swimming in as people in a highly individualized capitalist country with deep roots in racism. We are habituated to make some pretty snap decisions there. And so again, if we back up and just think differently about along these same lines, who's getting the answers, why, who's deciding the question, who's deciding what the answer is, that it can really improve things. Another thing I'll mention, I want to mention the We All Count project, a woman named Heather Kraus, who is astounding and amazing. If you all don't know her, go check her out. And she does a lot of really practical work around data equity, things like how to collect information about people's racial, ethnic, gender identities in more inclusive ways. One of the things we learned from her is something called an equity gap score. And it is dead simple. It's so brilliant. It's simply the score is the ratio between the group of the highest value of something and the lowest value of something. So for example, if people on the west side of town weigh 200 pounds on average, I'm making this up, people on the east side of town weigh 100 pounds on average, that equity gap score is 2. And what the equity gap score does is a nice bias interrupter, is in that it can show you at scale, because you can calculate it really easily on survey data, participation data, anything you want. Anything with an equity gap score of much more than one deserves a closer look. Sometimes the implications are pretty minimal. You had a little bitty sample size, or it's measured that it isn't that salient, but it's a really great way to just habituate that bias interrupter in your analysis so that you are being more consistent in the ways that you're directing your attention. So again, I think there's a lot of different ways that. And then, I think, like folks like our colleagues at the Culturally Responsive Evaluation and Assessment Center, they are doing some really amazing work around incorporating indigenous forms of knowledge into evaluation. How do we really rethink on a deep level what constitutes evidence and how do we collect it? And so, again, I think there's a really wide range of things that some of which wonderfully are fairly straightforward to implement. You can make your surveys and your intake forms less terrible pretty easily. And then some others do require more work, more innovation, and deeper thinking.
I love Heather Kraus. And one of the things that she also talks about is that looking at how we collect data isn't just about being fair. It's also a part of rigor, right? If you're asking questions that routinely exclude a particular group, or you're asking questions in a way that's going to make it harder for part of your population to answer than another, you're building inaccuracies into your data.
Yes, culturally responsive. And I learned something really similar from Geraldine Coffey, who's the founder of the Equitable Evaluation Initiative, that culturally appropriate methods are rigor. It's not a nice to have. It's not a, like, you live in the blue bubble, that's cute. Like, it is rigor. And again, that there's a whole lot of work that we can all be doing when it comes to to actually living into that, to see that as anything other than rigor in this very diverse multicultural society that we live in is foolish.
I remember listening to an evaluator who was doing a sort of broader evaluation of programs working with people who are experiencing homelessness. And she was talking about that they had a screening about sleep deprivation. And it was like 16 questions or whatever. And as she started looking at this, she realized how many of the questions didn't apply to somebody who didn't own a car, right? One of the questions was, do you fall asleep driving a car? And I'm like, you're asked, like, how is somebody who doesn't have a car going to answer that question? They'll probably say no, because they don't have a car, but that's the wrong answer, right? Maybe they're so exhausted they would fall asleep if they were driving a car, but you're not going to pick that up. And so again, yeah, just that idea that this has to be part of rigor, not a nice to have. Mm-hmm. So if we sort of back up, I think these are so many very practical ways that we can particularly bring values into the way that we do evaluation. Are there some other sort of last recommendations you might have just generally about how we can do evaluation better? Because I think, as you say, we do leave a lot to be desired sometimes in how we conduct and engage with our evaluation.
I think at the heart of it is just really pushing ourselves to be thoughtful about what will we do with the answer? Whose question of practice is getting answered? And that's not to say that there's no reason to answer a funder's question or question of practice at all. And I think just to really push ourselves there, because it does take time and effort on many people's behalf. Depending on the context, it can be traumatizing or re-traumatizing for people to give you the information that you're asking. And so let's be real hard on ourselves about what we're going to do with the answer so that we're really making the most of that experience. And then I think as part of that, you know, let's really push ourselves to humanize the process as much as we can. And evaluation data collection is a process of abstraction. That is what it is. And I think it there are ways to humanize it. There are ways to make it, just a less extractive process, a more collaborative process that aligns so much with the stated values of so many mission-driven organizations and align with so much of what they're already doing when it comes to their services and the ways they show up for people. And evaluation is just kind of one of those trailing, oftentimes kind of the trailing part of that transformation in organizations.
I was reminded of a story my mom told me after trying to go donate blood. And she got so fed up trying to fill in the intake form that she finally just walked out again. Because there was one issue where like the intake nurse had put her birth date in wrong somewhere early on. And in order for her to fix it, like she had to start the whole thing all over again. It couldn't be edited. And there were like several other things where she was like, I'm going to spend 25 minutes filling in your forms. And so when I think about humanizing how we collect data, part of it is just don't make it so onerous that you piss off the people who are trying to be engaged with it, which is a small part of humanizing, but it just made me think about
it. And it raises those questions about whose time is more valuable? Who is it on to fix it? And you know, is it the beleaguered nurse at the blood donation station or your mom? Like, those can be tough calls. But again, I think we're so habituated to think just associating money or wealth with value and whiteness with wealth and therefore with value that we don't even think of it. We don't even question those assumptions. And as you say, it's probably, you know, it's going to be a perpetual state of improvement and, you know, and short-term balance rather than sort of everything being fixed. Yeah. But there's a lot of room for opportunity or a lot of opportunity for improvement.
Well, and what I thought about too, wasn't just like, should it be my mom who fixes it or the nurse, but like, why doesn't their system let them edit one question? Right? Like, why should anybody have to go in and redo the entire thing rather than just being able to go in and say, I need to change this one field. Yeah. Let me type in a quick edit or make a comment that will update that one field, right? You know, so it's like an example of the system not taking care of the humans, right? And forcing the humans to adapt to that system.
Yeah. And it makes me think about the nonprofit starvation cycle, because dollars to donuts, they're running a database program that was cutting edge in 1996. And there's one person in the state who knows how to keep it up, and heaven help us when she retires. And
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I deeply appreciate all of your insights and the wonderful things that you've shared today. For people who want to connect with you, follow you, learn from you, maybe work with you, how can they find you?
Yeah, thank you so much. So again, my name is Corey Newhouse, and my organization is called Public Profit. You can visit us at www.publicprofit.net. Also, I am one of two Corey Newhouses in North America, according to Google, and I'm the one with curly reddish brown hair. So I'm pretty easy to find online. If you type in my name, it'll take you very close to, if not directly to, the Public Profit website. We're also, if you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, very active there and would love to be in touch.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You have been listening to Heart, Soul, and Data. This podcast is brought to you by Moroccanus, an analytics education, consulting, and data services company devoted to helping nonprofits and social enterprises amplify their impacts and thrive through data. You can learn more at Moroccanus.com, M-E-R-A-K-I-N-O-S.com.